retraining your brain and heart through meditation and compassion. It used to be that teaching mindfulness, meditation, and compassion was considered pretty far out. But today, these are subjects of serious mainstream medical research. One of the institutions leading the charge is the Center for Compassion and Altruism Research at Stanford University. The center's founder and leader is a neurosurgeon at Stanford with a remarkable life story. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll talk with Dr. James Doty about his new book, Into the Magic Shop, part memoir, part how-to book. Doty tells how a chance childhood encounter changed his life and how he ended up as an advocate for mindfulness and love. We'll also talk with Dr. James Wasserman, a nephrologist at Maine Medical Center, with a sustained interest in mindfulness. Maine Calling explores the heart and the mind next. But first, this news update. From the MPBN studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Jim Doty was raised in poverty with an alcoholic father and depressive mother. His life seemed destined for difficulty until a fateful trip to a magic shop where a kind woman taught him the power of mindfulness. Doty traces the successes in his life from college graduation to med school, where he became a neurosurgeon, to some spectacular investment successes, in large part to his ability to calm and cultivate his mind. Today, we're going to learn about Dr. Doty's journey and hear from a Maine physician who also has an interest in the role of mindfulness in medicine. On the line with us from Argo Studios in New York City is James Doty. He's the author of Into the Magic Shop, A Neurosurgeon's Quest to Discover the Mysteries of the Brain and the Secrets of the Heart. And with me in our studio, Dr. Jim Wasserman. He's a nephrologist with Maine Medical Center. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Jennifer.
My pleasure.
We want to hear from you, as always. What questions do you have about mindfulness, meditation, our heart, our mind, and how our brain can change? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Dr. Doty, I want to hear a little bit about your life story in just a little bit. But first, I want to start. You are the founder and director of something called the Center for Compassion and Altruism Research and Education at Stanford University. And I want to know, what is it you're doing there? What are you researching, hoping to find out? What are you finding out?
Well, for most people, it would seem to be intuitively obvious that being kind is a good thing. But that being said, the profound nature of how kindness and compassion affects one's body is really not well known. And one of our missions is to try to understand, if you will, the connection between the mind, the heart, how compassion impacts our own physiology, and amazingly, how it impacts the physiology of others. So what we do is we use different tools of neuroscience, such as functional magnetic resonance imaging, EEG, testing, both quantitative and qualitative testing, and then measure physiologic effects, such as effects on heart rate, blood pressure, release of stress hormones, effects on the immune system, things of this nature.
And are you finding, should I say, proof for some of the things that all of us have suspected all along?
Well, there's absolutely no doubt about that. And myself and other investigators have spent a great deal of time understanding this connection and documenting the profound effect that compassion has on each of us. And what's interesting is that if you look back on our evolution as a species, where we have something called theory of mind, abstract thinking, complex language, those characteristics which separate us from other species resulted in a need for our offspring to be cared for a long period of time, 10, 15, 20 years, in my case, 35 years apparently. I'm joking about my daughter, actually. But the thing is that our offspring could not survive unless there was this close connection. And there's a price for that connection to the parents. And unless there was something deep within us that made us connected to our offspring, we would not. And that connection, that nurturing, that caring, that love, that is so much a part of how we care for our offspring, is really hardwired into us, such that when we actually perform those actions or give that love or nurturing, it has a huge effect on our reward centers in our brains and also markedly affects our physiology in that it makes it, frankly, work at its best.
Dr. Wasserman, unlike Dr. Doty, who studies the brain, you're a nephrologist. You study kidneys. How did you become interested in this link? What is your interest in mindfulness and meditation and its medical application?
Well, I'll say I was fortunate enough to have an illness about 14 years ago that helped wake me up. And when I had this illness, which went on for about a year or 2 years, the only thing that I found that really helped me become better in a healthful manner was meditation that involved clearing my mind, opening my heart, and then learning to be kind to myself and to others. And from there, my interest has grown, not only for meditation for myself, but for teaching it to patients that I have the privilege of taking care of, and also teaching it to other caregivers, and now, like Dr. Doty, beginning to do some research in this area as well.
You said you teach it to your patients. What kind of impact has it had? What kind of patients are you teaching mindfulness and meditation to, and what kind of impact has it had?
Yeah. One of the great things about nephrology is you're both a specialist and a primary care physician, and you're a specialist in kidneys, dialysis, transplant, hypertension. But I'm very fortunate that I get to visit with my patients once a week. So I have more time than most to see people while they're getting dialysis or getting treatment. And during these treatments, you can explore different means of treatment, which are both very technical and very medically based in nephrology and dialysis and transplant. But you can find different avenues or paths towards healing, especially people that you see so often, and especially people who are getting dialysis 4 hours, three times a week. And this is part of the therapy that's available or becoming more available in some of the things that we're starting to study now.
Mm. Dr. Doty, it's interesting that Dr. Wasserman said that, because that's something that you talk about in your book, how important your time is with your patients and how important it is for you to see them as human beings and have time to work with them.
No, that's absolutely true. In fact, I just recently published a post in the Huffington Post called Why Kindness Heals. And the reality is that what sometimes is taken for granted is that not only is having an illness stressful, but for many people, engaging the healthcare system, which frankly in the U.S. especially is broken, is anxiety provoking. And when an individual, a physician, actually takes the time, and I use the term also compassionately listens, leans forward as an example to show that you're interested and engaged, makes the patient feel as if you're not rushed, and you actually touch the patient, every one of those actions has been shown to have significant effect on that person. And not only on their physiology at the time you're having this interaction, ultimately, as they continue in the healthcare system, it can have a profound effect. In fact, we're just beginning a study that shows how these types of interactions, giving people tools beforehand, if you will, to calm their mind and, if you will, think positively, actually has an effect on wound healing, scar tissue formation, and actually outcome.
Mm. I want to ask both of you, and Dr. Wasserman, I'll start with you. How has your work with this, the mindfulness and meditation and teaching other practitioners what you've learned, how is it received? Is there skepticism within the medical community?
Okay. For the people that come to learn, of course, it's a selected population, so there's little skepticism. And I have to say that I've helped the founder of this at MaineMed, a fellow, Dr. Joe Dreher, help him teach this to other physicians, nurses, physical therapists, and other caregivers, and it's very well received there. And the classes are full. We have to create more classes to accommodate everyone who wants to learn this method to approach patients to be more mindful, both in their practice in their lives and in their approach to medicine. The skepticism comes in not so much in that this doesn't work or this isn't a good treatment, but the skepticism comes in as, how am I going to do this? I've got 10 minutes to see someone. I have 15 minutes to see someone. How do I fit this in? And that's where the major part of the skepticism comes in. But that's also where the boundaries or the interfaces are with being mindful in those 10 or 15 minutes for yourself. And once you're mindful for yourself or fully present with the patient, the dance begins and you can fit it in. But learning to dance like that does take some instruction.
Dr. Doty, you're a surgeon. Mm-hmm. Surgeons fix things. How is this? How do you approach other surgeons and convince them that this is important?
I don't think Dr. Wasserman would like thinking that surgeons fix things and other people don't. But, but that's how we think, actually. the thing is that, interestingly, in some ways, surgery is a mental practice or process where you can be completely focused and be so attuned to what you're doing that you can actually turn everything else off. And those things you turn off can be being upset with a particular situation or a relationship or event, and you're just absolutely focused on the present moment. And really, that's what these types of practices help one do, because so many people, unfortunately, especially in the West, have a negative dialogue that goes on in their head, and they don't really appreciate it oftentimes until you point it out to them. And it can be one that beats them up every day and doesn't allow them to be kind to themselves. And it's interesting that when you're able to show someone through these types of practice we're talking about, then they're able to have more attention, more focus, and not emotionally respond to that dialogue. And over time, if you incorporate compassion, especially compassion for yourself, you're actually able to change the dialogue. And when you're able to not listen to the dialogue and or change the dialogue, it really has a profound effect, not only in regard to your emotional state and the stress that you're under by diminishing that, but really when you talk to people who've gone through these types of trainings, how their relationships have changed either with their loved ones or with those at work or in terms of creativity or productivity, it's actually sometimes quite profound, and it really shows you how this idea of neuroplasticity, how with repetition and intention, which is what I talk about in my book, how it can really change your life and, in fact, change the trajectory of your life.
Well, let's talk about that. Your book's entitled Into the Magic Shop, and the Magic Shop was a real place in your hometown of Lancaster, California. Tell me about the woman you met there, and we don't have time for the entire story, but how she changed your life, how she set your life on a different course.
Well, as you alluded to earlier, I'd come from a very dysfunctional background. My father was an alcoholic. My mother was an invalid who was chronically depressed, attempted suicide. We were on public assistance. Obviously not the ideal situation for a child to grow up. And in that context, I felt that I had no control over my environment. I tell people I felt like I was a leaf being blown by an ill wind. And when I walked just serendipitously into this magic shop, there was this woman. She was actually the mother of the owner of the magic shop, who was not there. She knew absolutely nothing about magic in that store. But after a brief conversation with me, asked me actually some pointed questions about my own background, she actually said, "Jim, I'm here for another 6 weeks, and if you come in, I think I could teach you something that could change your life." And it actually turned out to be an extraordinarily profound type of magic that changed my life, and that was the magic of, if you will, a magic of possibilities, a magic of learning how to, if you will, change how your brain functions, rewire your brain. And I tell people that what happened in that magic shop, because I was already on a trajectory probably to become a delinquent, but what happened in that magic shop made me change my perspective of having limited to no possibilities and the anger associated with that to changing it to one of unlimited possibilities. And fundamentally, Ruth, this woman, that is the gift that she gave me.
Mm. Dr. Wasserman, you read the book just recently as I did. What stood out to you about the work that Dr. Doty's doing and his life story?
What stood out to me first was how he's taken his life, as he says, changed it with the help of Ruth, and then realized you can apply it in many different ways. When you have this power to have more control over yourself, be more mindful of your own thoughts and actions, and it can be applied in a very helpful way, or in some instances, not be applied in a helpful way. So even though you have this newfound power or this newfound magic in your mind, the second important thing is to open up, in Dr. Doty's case, his heart. In mine, is we open up my kidneys. But you have to open up yourself to the goodwill of others and to help others and not to use this new, if you will, brain power for things that might not be so helpful for you in the long run.
All right. Well, we do have to take a break. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send us a brief email at talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post on our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Casella, committed to improving Maine's air quality through the conversion of landfill gas to energy. Casella, giving resources new life.
Presidential candidates have worked tirelessly to win support in Iowa.
God bless the great state of Iowa.
Iowa Democrats!
We love you all. Iowa is so important to me.
Thank you, Iowa!
Now the time has come for Iowans to choose a favorite. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Later today, we'll bring you results, reaction, and analysis from the first presidential contest of the year.
Live coverage of the Iowa caucuses from NPR News.
Our radio coverage gets underway tonight at 8 o'clock here on MPBN.
Last fall, China announced that its one-child policy would be lifted, allowing married couples to have two children. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with journalist Mei Fong, author of the new book, One Child. She traveled to a bachelor village with no women of marriageable age and met people whose one child died after they'd agreed to be sterilized. Join us.
You can join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock right here on MPBN Radio.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, what do we know about the connection between the brain and the heart? With me in our studio, Dr. Jim Wasserman. He's a nephrologist with Maine Medical Center and has an interest in the role of mindfulness in medicine. And on the line with us from Argo Studios in New York City is Dr. Jim Doty. He's the author of Into the Magic Shop, a neurosurgeon's quest to discover the mysteries of the brain and the secrets of the heart. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Dr. Wasserman, you noted at the beginning of the show that you've begun some research on the connection between mindfulness and health, and your specialty is looking at dialysis. What have you found?
So we did an initial pilot study where we trained or gave patients information on how to be present in the moment, to quiet their thoughts, and to develop a state of relaxation. And we then measured different modes of affect, whether someone felt they were in control, what their dialysis experience was like. And what was interesting is we didn't find many quantitative changes on our surveys or assays, but all the qualitative changes were, this has really made a difference in my life at home and what I'm experiencing at home. And there wasn't so much about the differences in the dialysis clinic. So we're going to try and build on that and continue some studies in terms of meditation as well as guided imagery in people receiving dialysis.
And Dr. Doty, I wanted to ask you about a phrase that you used earlier in the program, brain plasticity. Explain what that means, what you see as a neurosurgeon when you're talking about brain plasticity. Is this something measurable?
Well, yes, it is, and it's measurable in the context of how you go, if you will, from, let's say, not having an ability to do something to having an ability. We know that Eastern practices, which is where mindfulness has come from, especially in the context of Buddhism as an example, that monks who have developed this type of mind training can have a profound effect on their physiology in terms of lowering their blood pressure, lowering their heart rate, actually changing the type of waves that are present in their brain during certain types of activities, and be very attuned, if you will, to people's suffering. As an example, there's a monk by the name of Matthieu Ricard who's actually has become a friend of mine, but he's called the happiest man in the world. And the interesting thing is that he can actually modulate, if you will, different types of mental states. As an example, if you ask him to be empathetic, which is to take on the suffering or the emotional state of another, he can actually do that. And that part of the brain where that occurs, you can see actually increases in blood flow on functional magnetic resonance imaging. And in fact, he is so attuned to doing this that you could say, show me 25% empathy, 50%, and you can actually see the increases in blood flow as he does that. And the thing he will tell you, though, is that taking on this emotional state of another in regard to suffering, if you ask him to bring it all the way up, it's very, very, very painful. And unless you can, if you will, have a feeling that you want to engage and alleviate that suffering, the pain is incredibly profound. Yet when you actually have this desire or motivation to alleviate suffering, it suddenly changes things and that pain goes away, and actually this thought of giving love or embracing or nurturing or caring for someone actually then increases metabolism in your pleasure or reward center quite profoundly.
Mm. We're going to go to the phones now. We're going to start in Northport with Duncan. Hi, Duncan. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi, thanks. I used to teach at the family medicine department at UConn Medical School some of these ideas. I'm a minister and a therapist. But I wanted to mention up here in Belfast, there's a very interesting historical connection to the ideas that you guys are talking about. There was a man, as you may know, in the 1840s named Phineas Quimby. He was a clockmaker in Belfast, but he is known as the founder of the New Thought movement, the idea that your mind can change your body. One of his most famous patients was Mary Baker Eddy, and the ideas that come down through Norman Vincent Peale and the Power of Positive Thinking all come from Phineas Quimby in Belfast, and he was also a really compassionate man. He wouldn't charge money for people if they couldn't pay. And while he taught them the power of their mind, he also was full of his own heart. And that, I think, was a big part of his curative teachings. There's a book called One Simple Idea by Mitch Horowitz that traces this history. And since Belfast is his hometown, I thought I'd mention it.
Thanks so much. That's really interesting. Is this somebody whose work either of you has followed?
Yes, actually, it's interesting that he mentions that. He did have actually a profound effect. And in fact, it's interesting because what happens to one, if you will, when they become self-aware and understand these practices, ultimately you understand that while there is this internal transformation, the thing that gives us meaning, and frankly, all of us want meaning in our lives or to feel that our actions have been a benefit. Some use the term transcendence. That only can occur, if you will, through an outward journey. And that's an outward journey of connection. And that connection is manifested, if you will, by having an open heart and embracing others. The other aspect is that oftentimes, and one of the things that makes it difficult is when somebody is hostile to us, unless we take this moment of reflection, we have this immediate emotional response to, let's say, anger or hostility. But we don't realize, though, is that in some ways, everyone is suffering. And when we step back a moment and process this reality and process the fact that oftentimes the manner in which someone reacts is not so much having anything to do with us or the actions we've done, but in frankly, our reaction to their own pain and suffering that is occurring and that they've not connected to. And so when you think about it that way, it sort of changes how you look at the world, and it also allows you to not act emotionally to an event, but to sit back for a moment and reflect and then realize that emotional response you initially were going to have is not going to be a benefit to you or to the other person.
I think one of the important things brought up by Dr. Doty and also Phineas Quimby is when you're present and you're non-judgmental and you're, if you want, open-minded, you can develop an authentic relationship with the person in front of you. And through this, what I call authenticity, something beautiful then grows. It's less emotional. It's more cognitive. And at the end of the day, you haven't gotten through your day just to get through your day, but you've established something that's true and real and something to build on in an authentic relationship. And I think particularly in medicine and in many other areas, if there's not authenticity in the relationship by being present, by being non-judgmental, by being open to different conversations, you don't have much at the end of the day.
Thanks so much for your call, Duncan. We're going to move to Bangor and Larry. Hi, Larry. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
I don't know if you're familiar with it. There was a book about 40 years ago called The Relaxation Response, and I'm wondering how your work differs from that. If you don't know it, you can't answer it. And the other question I have, excuse me, is I've had considerable numbers of operations, and I'm in a lot of pain, and I use some sort of energy somehow to ignore that pain, and I'm wondering if you're talking about that.
Sure. The relaxation response by Dr. Benson, who is in Amherst, in some ways he is exploring some of the things that we're talking about. And in fact, although unnamed, in some ways this is exactly what Ruth was talking about. And this is what Eastern philosophers have been talking about for thousands of years. And initially this was by trial and error, and oftentimes intertwined with religious or philosophical dogma. And then with the work of Dr. Benson and others, it was found that, in fact, you could actually quantitatively study these states and how different types of mental practices impact your physiologic state. So, yes, I am familiar with him, and his work is actually quite profound, and it has been built on over the last few decades. And as you point out, with these types of practices, you can modulate pain. The work of Jon Kabat-Zinn in regard to mindfulness-based stress reduction has been well documented to have an effect on individuals' perceptions of pain. And you have to remember, oftentimes, whether it's pain or other events that are happening to you which cause an emotional response, the reality is that it's not so much the events that are affecting you. It is, in fact, your response to those events. As an example, as a child, after the work I had done with Ruth, my personal circumstances did not change. My father was suddenly not an alcoholic, or my mother was suddenly not depressed. But what profoundly changed was actually how I reacted to those events. And it wasn't that I didn't react, but I didn't have the same emotional reaction. I had an acceptance without judgment, as was pointed out by Dr. Wasserman. And it's that non-judgmental response that really helps you change everything.
I think the relaxation response, whether in book or just in talking, is such an important thing. Many of the people I get to see or take care of, a large proportion of them have pain. They describe pain and insomnia, restless legs, depression. And part of that is to be able to, if you want, to take a breath, to step away from it for a minute, and to look at the pain from the outside and not let the pain consume you or, if you want, bring on additional emotions which then activate a different nervous system, such as the sympathetic nervous system, and drive that pain even more. And then you find someone is just suffering because they feel like they can't control anything. the pain begets emotions, the emotion begets pain, and you're into a really vicious cycle. One of the helpful things, in addition to traditional medicine, which treats pain immediately, is to have give someone the tools or the gifts where they can begin to drop into the relaxation response, turn off that sympathetic nervous system, and begin to watch their emotions or control their emotions and have control over their pain rather than vice versa. And then you see the suffering begin to fall and the person begin to bloom.
All right. Thanks so much for your call, Larry. We're going to move to Winterport and Judy. Hi, Judy. Go ahead.
Hi. I wanted to tell you first that I've experienced this phenomenon. I have an adult son who had a brain injury as a teenager in an accident, and I've watched him profit from mindfulness and meditation. It's been extremely helpful to him. And my question is whether there's a role for this in training of foster parents who frequently end up, as I understand it, with children from addictive homes.
Dr. Doty, do you have thoughts?
Well, I think what we're finding is, and I don't want to imply that these practices are a panacea for everything. First of all, it does take work. It takes time. But there's no question anyone who's in a stressful or difficult situation in which there is a lot of, if you will, emotion involved or emotional reactivity can benefit from these types of practices. Just to mention, you had said that you had a son who had a traumatic brain injury. There's actually an interesting book out by Jane McGonigal called Super Better that actually uses some of these techniques and others to actually benefit individuals who've had traumatic brain injuries. And in fact, she had one herself.
Thanks for your call, Judy. Moving to Rockland and Jeffrey. Hi, Jeffrey. Go ahead.
Oh, there you are. I would like to say kudos to the two doctors. Thank you very much for what you're doing. I am 73 years old. 40 years ago, I was in therapy with a psychiatrist in New York named Theodore Isaac Rubin, which the doctors, who the doctors may know or know of. And he wrote a book called Compassion and Self-Hate, in which he was very forthcoming about his own three-year battle with depression and finally arrived at the, I guess, the survival point where he realized and that compassion, in his mind, was the only antidote to what he called self-hate and self-battering. I don't want to step on Dr. Doty's book, but Compassion and Self-Hate is an extraordinary book. And at the very beginning of the book, he goes, Dr. Rubin mentions something that was said by a rabbi circa 100 BC, which was, if I am not for myself, who will be? But if I'm only for myself, what am I? And I continue to struggle for 40 years with depression on and off, but I think for a lot of people there's enormous value in what you're teaching, and thank you.
Jeffrey, what you said reminded me of one of the passages I marked in Dr. Doty's book. I'm going to read this if this is okay with you, Jim. There is an epidemic of loneliness, anxiety, and depression in the world, particularly in the West. There is an impoverishment of spirit and of connection with one another. Studies show 25% of Americans have no one they feel close enough with to share a problem. This means that one out of every four people you see or meet today has no one to talk to, and that this lack of connection is affecting their health. That's an astonishing number.
Indeed it is. Compassion Self-Hate is a profound book. I am a promoter of all books that can bring individuals meaning or help them, if you will, on their path. So I don't want to act like I'm only interested in promoting my own work, because I'm interested in promoting everyone who has a positive message and can give each of us advice that can be of benefit. But this idea of self-hate, and this is what I alluded to earlier, so many people in the West are not compassionate or kind to themselves. And as a result, they keep ruminating over a negative message about who they are, what they are. And this is really the problem, this rumination. And when you, if you will, start this journey to be kind to yourself and then with intention be kind to others, first of all, it separates you from that rumination process and makes you realize that other individuals are suffering, so that it's no longer just about your own suffering. But when you recognize so many people are also suffering, and that you can be a benefit to them by being present and being compassionate, it really changes a paradigm for many people and gives them a toolbox, if you will, in which they can use these techniques to help themselves and oftentimes help many others.
We do have to take another break. When we return, more of your comments and questions. Please stay with us. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible. As does Friends School of Portland, now accepting applications for preschool through grade 8. Information at friendsschoolofportland.org. Interested in what's taking place in Iowa today and what it means? Maine Public Radio is the place to be this evening as we learn about what transpired with the Iowa caucus. Our coverage starts at 8 o'clock with special coverage from Iowa Public Radio and WNYC in New York City, and then we hand it off to our friends at NPR at 9 o'clock. In addition, Maine Public Television will sum things up at 11 with a special report from the PBS NewsHour team. Political coverage on both Maine Public Radio and television, that's this evening at 8 on radio and 11 on television. And coming up in just a few minutes at 1 o'clock right here on MPBN Radio, Jane Goodall's Hope. Ideas from the CBC. We'll talk to Jane Goodall, who's a pioneering primatologist and conservationist. They'll discuss the evolving relationship between humans and animals, saving the planet, and the role the next generation can play in both. That's Jane Goodall on Ideas from the CBC, coming up in just a bit at 1 o'clock right here on MPBN Radio.
And welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, the power of meditation and mindfulness and compassion and its effect on the heart and mind. With me in the studio, Dr. James Wasserman. He's a nephrologist with Maine Medical Center and has a sustained interest in the role of mindfulness in medicine. On the line with us, James Doty, also a doctor. He's the author of Into the Magic Shop, A Neurosurgeon's Quest to Discover the Mysteries of the Brain and the Secrets of the Heart. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Jim Wasserman, before we went to break, we were talking about the epidemic of depression and anxiety and loneliness in the Western world. We had to go to a break, but I wanted to give you a chance to talk about how this feeds into the importance of community.
Sure. When I was finishing my fellowship, I read a book by Saul Bellow called More Die of the Broken Heart. I found it to be a very insightful and important book, but I wasn't sure how it was going to fit into practice or where it was going to come back in what I was pursuing in my life. Fast forwarding to now, when people come to transplant or to nephrology care or particularly to dialysis, if they're alone or they don't have community, these are the people who don't do well. And by not doing well, they become sick more often, they enter the hospital, or they die much sooner. And one of the issues in providing compassionate care is to find a community for someone. And that community can be family, it can be friends, it can be within the dialysis clinic itself among the people they see three times per week, or it can be with their healthcare providers. But I think breaking down the barriers of loneliness is one of the most important things that healthcare providers can do, because having support in whatever fashion it is, I think, is so important to people's physical, mental, and combined health.
Dr. Doty, I want to return to the calls in just a minute, but first I want to ask you about the big part of your book that's sort of different than other books I've read, other discussions I've seen on TED Talks and heard on the radio. A lot of talk out there right now between the connection of the mind and meditation. In fact, the word for it is mindfulness, but you're talking about the heart as much as the mind. And you argue that the heart is as powerful or more powerful than the mind.
Well, in fact, what Dr. Wasserman was alluding to, this connection or this compassion, that is what the heart is all about. You know, on a cognitive level, we can read about these things and understand them. But it's really when you actually open your heart to be compassionate to others, to understand that other people are suffering, to understand your own suffering, that you get the greatest physiologic benefit. It's interesting because there have been studies done, and now we're hearing more about this, where mindfulness, which is really an attention and focus technique and also not responding to internal dialogue and, if you will, being present, it can be a negative thing in that if you're a type A personality or narcissistic, it may not offer you any benefit other than to be a better narcissist and a more ruthless person. It's really the critical part to this, which is, I believe, the most powerful part, which is the compassion component, because that is where you will find, and Dr. Wasserman alluded to this with his patients, and multiple studies have shown this, that when you practice kindness, compassion, caring, and this connection to others, that's when you really get the profound benefit, which can actually be more beneficial for your health than either being at your ideal body weight or doing exercise. That's how powerful it is.
Wow. We're going to go to Douglas in Portland. Hi, Douglas. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to ask a question of the doctors there. As far as it would seem to me that with this mindfulness and things like that, that the people that would benefit from it the most might be the least likely to kind of go after it by themselves. You know, if somebody is depressed and has anxiety, you know, motivation is often a factor. And so I'm just wondering if you, you know, for people that have like a family member who could really benefit from this, but just don't take the step themselves to get started, like what can family members do to perhaps get somebody involved with, this type of therapy?
Sure. Dr. Wasserman, do you have thoughts?
Sure. Thanks for the question. It's a great question. How do you motivate someone or wake someone up to the ideas of mindfulness which might be helpful for them? As a offshoot or part and parcel of mindfulness, there's actually a technique called motivational interviewing, which is interviewing someone in a mindful manner, again, being present and non-judgmental and being with the person, turning truly towards the person, and having a conversation about what's important to that person, what they would like to see change, what the barriers to the change are, when they think they'll be ready for the change, and what do they think would be important to make these changes. And this technique, if you will, has been found to be very successful in helping people arrive at more successful behavior. Oftentimes, telling someone what to do, or what's traditionally called directing interviewing, won't be so successful in this manner. But employing techniques like motivational interviewing might help lead someone to where they might be in a more helpful situation.
Mm. We're going to head to Belfast and Judith. Hi, Judith. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm from Belfast, and I was about to introduce myself as the magician of Belfast at the beginning because I do teach mindfulness-based stress reduction. These doctors are fabulous, and they have said more than I would wish anyone to say about mindfulness. And to mention the heart and the mind, one thing Dr. Doty probably knows is the Oriental way of looking at the heart and the mind are to use the same word. But what I really wanted to say is more scientific. The nuts and bolts here are that it takes 2.5 hours a week for 8 weeks with 5 hours of silent retreat and 20 or 30 minutes of daily practice to learn these skills. And it's hard work. And people are tremendously motivated by listening to programs just exactly like this, to hear what really sounds magical and wonderful. It's really the basics of love yourself, love one another. But please remember the scientific piece that says how long it takes to create a habit. That is self-satisfying, because the more you gain any of these skills, the happier you become, but it takes hard work.
Dr. Doty, you had mentioned repetition and intention. Boy, somebody might be listening to Judith right now and thinking to themselves, 20 or 30 minutes a day, I don't have that.
You know, it's funny. There's a Buddhist monk who said, if you don't have an hour a day to practice, or if you don't have 15 minutes a day to practice meditation, then you need to practice it for an hour a day. And the meaning is, of course, that there's always that bit of time. If each of us looks at our own lives and see frequently how much time we waste in doing things that don't benefit us. But I would also like to say that, yes, many of these types of training programs, and actually at Stanford, we've developed one called a Compassion Cultivation Training Program, or CCT, that is now taught throughout the world, that very directly and with intention includes the compassion component as well as the mindfulness component. But it does take work. It would be great if each of us could magically wake up and everything in our lives is perfect. Life does not work that way. But that being said, what does happen over time if you initially take that first step or that, you know, as they say, each journey starts with that first step, is that over time it becomes easier and easier, like any habit. And in fact, it gets integrated into just how you think and how you function. I also just wanted to make a brief comment about what Dr. Wasserman had said about the meditative or the listening aspect, motivational listening. Thich Nhat Hanh, who's a famous Zen Buddhist monk, makes a similar type of argument in terms of compassionate listening. And it's all very much the same because all of us know that when somebody directly comes at us with wanting us to change our behavior, oftentimes we feel attacked or actually afraid to admit that we're not doing what we should be doing. But when somebody recognizes our own degree of suffering and actually says, look, I'm here for you, I understand, I know it's hard, it changes the paradigm a bit where we're often then much more likely to actually change our behaviors and get involved in things such as mindfulness or compassion cultivation.
Dr. Dr. Wasserman, I wanted to ask you, Judith was talking about people who enroll in a program that this takes 8 weeks of a certain amount of time every day. And I'm thinking about your patients, especially those who are on dialysis and who are coming 3 times a week for 4 hours and maybe in the days in between have waning energy and may not be in a position to enroll in a program. And you can correct me if I'm wrong. Do you give them, what kind of advice do you give them of small changes they can make given their situation?
Great question, because enrolling in a program, just those three words, four words, can be daunting to people. So people want to often have something they can take home in their pocket when they leave or after visiting with you. And there are many different ways to go about this, I believe. One is to practice breathing techniques while someone is present with you. And there are many and myriad different types of breathing techniques to slow the heart, to activate the parasympathetic nervous system. And after 10 minutes of practice with you, we'll be available to anyone who wants to use them whenever they want, and they can pull them out and use them. And this will help steady, relax, bring someone closer to a state of peacefulness. There are many CDs out there, some that are excellent, some not so excellent, but oftentimes I'll make recommendations to people. Buy the CD. This is everywhere. You can find it. Or if someone likes to read, there are many, many readable text, how-to text, how to do this. And then finally, as someone grows or say, well, I think I might be ready for the next step, there are programs at Maine Medical Center. There are more practitioners in the Portland area than you can shake a leaf at who can help you with this. And it's more of a matter of saying, well, I'm ready for this, or I think this is something I want to wake up to.
All right. And Dr. Doty, in your book, you outline very clearly the steps that Ruth taught you and that how what you recommend people do. We just have a few seconds. Do you have a final bit of advice for those listening today?
Well, I think there are perhaps two words. One is, as Dr. Wasserman was alluding to, and what I try to do in this book is to give you some insight into the power of these practices, which are relaxing the body, taming the mind, opening the heart, and having clarity of intention. And The other thing not to forget is that while each of us may be suffering in some way or another, the power of being of service or caring for another or acting compassionate with intention, as we were both talking about earlier, really, really has a profound positive effect on not only you but and the person you're caring for, but so many others around. And we've shown this through science. And I tell people, because oftentimes say, wow, there's so much suffering in the world. You know, I feel overwhelmed by it. Or what can I do? I don't have money. I don't have X, Y, or Z. And the reality is that each of us has the ability to positively affect another person's life every day, no matter who we are. And sometimes it can just be saying a kind word, opening a door, or sharing a smile with someone. And all of these things, although they seem simple or small, are incredibly powerful.
All right. Well, great last words, Dr. Doty, Dr. Wasserman. Thank you both for joining us today. James Doty is the author of Into the Magic Shop, A Neurosurgeon's Quest to Discover the Mysteries of the Brain and the Secrets of the Heart. James Wasserman is a nephrologist with Maine Medical Center and has a sustained interest in the role of mindfulness in medicine. Nikki Shields ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our audio archives by visiting mainecalling.net. Today's program will be rebroadcast this evening at midnight. The executive producer of Maine Calling is Jonathan Smith. Tomorrow on the program, from knitting to spinning and weaving, a look at the fiber arts in Maine. Join me for a conversation about the fiber arts industry in Maine and beyond, and why fiber arts enthusiasts from around the world make Maine a destination. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.